From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We'll get you updated on the news that made headlines this week and quite a bit to get to. So let me introduce our panelists. Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter for the Idaho Statesman, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
So I want to begin with some news in regards to abortion access here in Idaho. It looks like Idaho voters may get to decide on whether abortion would be protected in our state. And Nicole, let's start with you. Can you first begin and tell us about this nonprofit organization who is moving this forward?
Sure, Gemma. So Idahoans United for Women and Families is the name of the nonprofit. They submitted 4 petitions to the Secretary of State yesterday that would potentially become the ballot measure that they circulate for signatures in the future. And it's a pretty new group. Excuse me. They came out in April and kind of debuted some polling numbers that they had done on abortion and public opinion here in Idaho on the topic. And it consists of a lot of different people. You've got healthcare providers. Their board members include a pastor and folks from all over the state. So it's a pretty diverse group.
And with that said, Nicole, on Thursday, this group took the first official step, correct, to get this initiative? And this would be on the ballot in 2026. So tell us about that first initial step and then what comes next.
Sure. So it's definitely a ways off. As you mentioned, it wouldn't be on the ballot until 2026, and there are some hurdles to pass. So they submitted 4 different versions of potential legislation. They're going to select one based on the feedback that they're getting from the public and different stakeholders. But right now, they've got these 4 different options that would protect access to things like contraception and fertility treatments and also restore abortion access. And so they've got these petitions in. The Attorney General Raul Labrador will take a look at them. His office will offer suggestions for like the legal language in them. And the group can choose whether it wants to adopt those or reject them. And then the Attorney General's office will give the ballots titles. So this will be what officially shows up if it makes it onto people's ballots in 2026. This is what it will be titled as. And he has say over what that ends up being. And the group has said they're prepared to potentially litigate if they feel that the titles are unfair to what they're trying to do.
And so, Nicole, if I am, I'm looking at you, the article that you wrote, and so I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this properly right now. So, as you said, they have 4 like petition options they're looking at, correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Correct.
And those would be they're saying gestational cutoffs for abortion care, 20 weeks, 24 weeks, or before fetal viability. And then that 4th petition would cover only a right to abortion under certain circumstances. So, so the Attorney General, then, as you said, he gets to recommend any revisions or alterations. I mean, could he come back within this, 20 business day process and say none of them would work?
He could. Possibly, but I think it's more of, you know, cleaning up language than it is rejecting it, because this is a citizen ballot proposal. He doesn't really have the power to outright say, no, we will not be considering this in its entirety. So it's going to be more of an editing process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And with that said, too, what I think is interesting is the polling that this nonprofit group took and the fact that there is fairly, I mean, at least from what they have done. So, I mean, maybe, you know, maybe other polling would look different, but there's a lot of support for a ballot initiative like this.
What they said they found is a lot more support than maybe they anticipated or that you would expect in a heavily conservative state. So they said, excuse me, somewhere around 60% of people surveyed said that they believe abortion should be legal in some or all cases, versus I believe it was 12% who were staunchly against abortion ever happening in any circumstances. And then another about 20, 25% who said they think it should be pretty limited.
So, Scott, jump into the conversation here because you recently wrote an opinion piece on what happens when our state legislatures only represent a small minority of Idahoans. Some would argue that not having access to abortion care is only listening to a small portion of the population, as Nicole just stated in that polling, that when this nonprofit polled people, polled Idahoans, only 12% said, they disagreed with access to abortion care.
Right, and we've talked about this before. The Citizens Initiative is built into our Constitution, and we've seen it play out with Medicaid expansion. We've seen it play out with public education funding. We're seeing it play out now with open primaries. And as Nicole mentioned, the group's polling showed that 63% favored legal abortion in some or all cases. The Idaho Public Policy Survey last year, you might recall, they polled folks on this question very specifically about whether Idaho's existing abortion law should change. And 58% of those polled said that it should be changed. So, a lot of the discussion about the abortion law has centered around the health of the mother. And there has been a small group of folks who have been working, trying to work with the legislature over the past 2 years to try to get some of these horror stories that we've heard about pregnant mothers who have bad pregnancies and they can't get an abortion and they're airlifted out of the state, or their future fertility is jeopardized or damaged. And so the Idaho Medical Association and the Idaho Hospitals Association have been trying to get legislation to at least clean that up and try to carve out some exceptions where the health of the mother is in danger, and to no avail. And so the legislature and primarily the Republican legislators just won't listen to those concerns. They've dismissed the concerns. They've said that they're overblown or they're simply made up. And so the only recourse for citizens who want to change the law is a citizens' initiative. And if the polling holds out, it has a good shot, depending on which petition makes it onto the ballot. I think there's a heavy appetite among the citizenry to change the law in some respect.
And Scott, in your opinion piece that you wrote, I mean, you cited examples of, what's been happening over the last 2 years since this, very restrictive abortion ban has gone into place in Idaho. And if, and if people, if leaders want to say that, some of these stories are overblown, okay, fine, if that's your opinion. With that said, though, the facts show that Idaho has lost 22% of its OBGYNs in the past 2 years. And this is a really big deal. And Idaho hospitals are reporting that they're having difficulty recruiting doctors to our state. So this, and we already have a doctor shortage. So again, Scott, it seems that, this petition, to try to get this to try to get this initiative on the ballot, it's bigger in so many ways than only access to abortion, because so many people need access to doctors and OBGYNs that frankly have nothing to do with pregnancy.
And also too, it turns out that doctors sometimes will marry other doctors. And so even though you may not need an OBGYN, well, your eye doctor or your knee doctor might actually be married to an OBGYN who wants to leave the state. And so you may lose that physician. And then, yeah, just kind of the general anti-medical establishment mentality and attitude in Idaho, shows that hospitals are having a difficult time recruiting doctors, no matter what field they may be in. Anecdotally, we've heard that businesses are having difficulty recruiting workers to Idaho. And I can't tell you how many times I ran into somebody in the grocery store last week who has three kids or four kids in medical school. And he says, I'm probably, if I want to see them, if I want to live near them, I'm probably gonna have to move out of Idaho because they're probably not gonna move back to Idaho. And so, again, legislators can choose to listen or not. And if they don't choose to listen, but it's a real concern among the citizens, then they can make up their minds and decide what we want those laws to be in Idaho.
Don, I want to talk a little bit about a really big project going on in downtown Boise right now. And if folks are on State Street anytime, they've seen this construction happening because it has to do with a project that's involving the YMCA. But Don, why is this project potentially under threat?
Yeah, it's a ticking clock here.
Yeah.
This is a very complicated project, and even when I put this on the list to talk about today, I knew I was signing up for trying to explain complicated things. So bear with me and realize we've got more on our story on Boise Dev. Here's the deal. The Capital City Development Corporation and the YMCA, along with a development partner, have been working for several years to really reshape the neighborhood around the existing Y, right, just to the south of Boise High School. The new YMCA would move to a brand new building exactly across the street from State Street, kind of a mirror image, although much nicer, newer facility. Behind that would be a parking garage that originally had been proposed to have senior housing. This is going to be a kind of a high-rise type building, about 20 stories. Next to that, there was going to be a project with some market rate and workforce housing. So workforce housing is kind of a shortcut to say more affordable pricing, usually subsidized in some way. Because the Urban Renewal Agency, which is the Capital City Development Corporation, has a ticking clock on their ability to spend money in the area, it's making it kind of difficult to make this project happen. Urban renewal law in Idaho limits the amount of time that each agency can have what's called an urban renewal area. And that actually varies because legislators have decreased the length of these districts over time. This district is set to terminate 2 years from September, so 24 months away in 2026. So here's the problem. You might have noticed that interest rates are high. And you might have also noticed that the market for apartments has taken off with lots of new apartments. That's led to some decreasing rents. And then the third issue here is that construction costs remain really high nationally, and then specifically in the Boise Valley, due in large part to the $15 billion Micron project and the nearly $1 billion Meta project in Kuna. This mix of factors has made it very difficult to get this through. We've been following this for quite a while. We wrote a story last week that I'd worked on for a couple of months, and then a week later, it was almost completely out of date. Right now, where this stands is the project to build the parking garage, along with the senior housing, has basically been cut back to just building a parking garage for the YMCA. And the project that was going to include some apartments and some workforce has been changed to only include the subsidized housing portion of that. The challenge is that there's currently no financing in place for that. And the developer is hoping to get a partnership with the Boise City Ada County Housing Authority, which some people I've learned call BCHCHA, which is now my very favorite thing in local government. This is a government agency that's half appointed by the City Council of Boise and half appointed by the Ada County Commission. If they were to agree to be part of this, and that's very unclear, it would be their largest project that they would own. The developer would operate the workforce housing. But what's complicating here is that the developer has until about October 15th to get this deal done to do the workforce housing. And it's unclear if CCDC will approve changing this originally kind of 20-story large project with senior housing to just a parking garage. It would have a daycare center on the ground floor and some retail as well, but mostly kind of just a parking garage. So it's very different than what was initially proposed. The YMCA tells me they're ready to move forward. They've got their own separate funding to move to the new building. They think it's going to cost somewhere south of $80 million. And they're a nonprofit and have been raising money for this for a while. But their project hangs on getting this parking garage built. As anybody who's been to that YMCA, or if you're a Boise High School student, or even you just work in the area, you know that parking down there is pretty tricky. And the current Y parking is really hard. I'm not a Y member, but I know people who are, and it's really, really tough.
I am. It's really difficult.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people, because it's in the more urban part of the area, they bike or walk or, but you know, if you come in from Southeast Boise, you need a place to park your car, most likely, unless you're taking the bus. And so they're going to build a bigger Y with even more services. They really need that parking garage to happen. And it's unclear how that might happen. So what was initially pitched is kind of reimagining this whole neighborhood might not happen. And we're going to be watching it. I don't think the YMCA wants to build a new Y and have a bunch of parking lots around it. And so a lot of leaders are trying to figure out what comes next in this. And we're watching really closely because this is going to be one of the biggest, biggest projects in downtown Boise history, honestly. It would rival the inflation adjusted spend on the Simplot and Jump building downtown. And so it would have been one of the biggest things. And it kind of is looking like it may not happen. And even if it does, it would probably be significantly scaled back.
Okay. Well, I mean, definitely. I think a lot of eyes are on this, Don. So of course, folks, you can read a lot more on Boise Dev about this, but we will just have to sit here and I guess and wait to see what happens come October. Yeah. So that is Supreme Court made a decision in regards to the open primary initiative being on November's ballot. Logan, before we get into that decision, can you just remind folks what this initiative is?
Absolutely. So this ballot initiative filed by the Idahoans for Open Primaries group seeks to reform Idaho's election laws. If passed by the voters this November, the election initiative would reform. It would change the primary to a top four primary system, and it would make the general election a ranked choice voting system, is the long and short of it.
Okay, so Logan, the Attorney General's office sued the Secretary of State's office. Basically, the Attorney General's office saying this is these are two separate topics. You can only have one topic in an initiative. They wanted to keep the initiative off the ballot. This goes to the Idaho Supreme Court. And what happens?
Sure. Yeah. The Attorney General filed with the Supreme Court seeking to block the initiative from making it onto the ballot. And his argument was he argues that it's unconstitutional and embraces more than one subject. The Attorney General's eyes, the primary initiative reforms and the general election reforms should not be in the same initiative, in his opinion. But the Supreme Court ruled that it is too early for them to weigh in on that issue. They said that the constitutionality of the initiative would not be up for review unless and until voters pass it. So they said it was premature to adjudicate that factor. The other argument, and kind of the main argument that Labrador was making, is his office is arguing that the Idahoans for Open Primaries group has been misleading people as they were collecting the signatures. It kind of gets into some of the technical aspects of how this open primary or new top four primary would work. It's slightly different, or it's actually quite a bit different than the old open primary system that Idaho had pre-2011. Mm-hmm. So Labrador's argument was, because in his eyes, the signature gatherers gathered signatures fraudulently and didn't accurately represent that their initiative would implement ranked choice voting, stuff like that. His argument was all of the signatures should be invalidated and the whole petition should be thrown out. Basically, it should not appear on the November ballot. So that was the action he filed with the court, hoping to get the court to direct the Secretary of State not to validate the initiative and put it on the ballot. But the court decided that that was not the proper remedy. They said that there's no real actual clear legal duty under the initiative laws for that to be the Secretary of State's role. The way this works is that the signatures are collected on a local level, turned into the county clerks. The county clerks verify them and then they get submitted to the Secretary of State. So the court said that this is the wrong avenue to try and address these issues. They said the allegations of fraud in the signature collection process are serious, but this was not the right venue to sort it out. So if Labrador's office wants to challenge the veracity of the signatures, they said he needs to do it at a lower level district court first before it makes its way up to the Supreme Court.
So Scott, can you talk to us a little bit more about that and what the Supreme Court said in regards to Attorney General Labrador's understanding of what the court's role actually is?
Yeah, they weren't kind. And this is their words. They said Labrador's petition, quote, fundamentally misapprehends the role of this court under the Idaho Constitution and the role of the Secretary of State under the initiative laws enacted by the legislature. And Logan touched on this, but essentially saying, wow, you're alleging fraud here. That's pretty serious. But you know, you don't come to the Supreme Court first. You go to a district court. And if you lose in district court, then you come to the Supreme Court, right? So kind of saying you came to the wrong place. And then similarly with the signatures or the single subject issue, again, it was you have to wait until a law is passed. And this law is not passed. And you know, then you can sue and say that this law is invalid, but not in the middle of it. And Logan can correct me if my understanding of this is wrong, but the way I see it is that if, you know, it's similar to the process in the legislature. A bill goes before a committee and then it goes to the House floor and then it goes to another committee and then the Senate floor. And during that process, you might have a bill that is unconstitutional, but you don't sue the legislature in the middle of the deliberation of that bill. You wait until that bill is passed. Then you can say, okay, this bill is now passed and enacted and it is unconstitutional, but you can't do that until then. And I will point out that several people pointed this out previously, that the Attorney General's office can't sue to stop this initiative on the constitutionality question until it's actually passed. But the Attorney General's office, you know, did not listen to that advice and went ahead anyway. And the Supreme Court, you know, rightly said, you know, you have a fundamental misapprehension of how this court works.
Mm-hmm. So I am assuming then at this point, Scott, that we will now officially see this on the ballot come November with these rulings.
It would seem so. Now, of course, Attorney General Labrador could actually take that fraud allegation to a district court. But the supporters of the initiative say there's just not enough time between now and the election for that to happen. So for all intents and purposes, there's likely no avenue for that to happen, in which case it would indeed be on the November ballot. And again, Logan can maybe weigh in on that, too.
Yeah, the AG's office wasn't super committal so far as to what their next steps would be. But yeah, Scott's pretty much got the picture there. If Labrador had been successful in this attempt, the court, basically what he was asking was the court to throw out all of the signatures under the presumption that they were all invalid because of deceptive marketing. But with the asterisk that I'm not an attorney, what I think this means is that if they want to get signatures thrown out as being collected fraudulently, I think this means they have to go and actually, they would have to like identify specific signatures to get struck out rather than just throw out the whole batch across the state.
Okay. So Don, there have been some really big money deals happening for some Idaho companies recently. And when I say big money, I mean, we're talking what, in the billions? That's with a B.
Yeah. So you track valuations of companies. They like to say that any company that is startup that is valued at $1 billion or more is a unicorn. And a couple of unicorns got bought in the last couple of weeks. The first is PetIQ, which is based in Eagle. This company it's actually on the stock market. It was acquired by a private equity firm called Bansk Group. I always want to say Banks Group. It's Bansk Group from the East Coast. That billion and a half dollar deal, this company kind of did something funny. They sort of said, you know, we're going to keep on going, no layoffs. But my colleague, Angela Palermo at The Statesman, had a fantastic story that noted that the company laid off hundreds of people with an email delivered at 10:47 p.m. the night before the deal was announced. The company told the Statesman that it wasn't related to the merger, and they did it to right-size a specific division. These layoffs were mostly not in Idaho. It was 250 to 300 people, according to Angela's story, around the company, with a few here in Idaho. But you do have to question the timing of a 10:47 p.m. email from legal saying, hey, you're laid off. And then the next morning, they say they're being acquired. But again, the spokesperson said it wasn't related. So you can decide for yourself what's correct there. Then this week, Power Engineers, based in Haley, who also has a large presence in Meridian at Eagle View Landing, announced that they would be purchased by Canadian professional services firm WSP. This is a $1.78 billion deal, and they will also keep most of their 4,000 employees or so intact. They have 50 locations across the country. And again, they're based in Haley, so not even here in the Treasure Valley. So it's two deals valued at more than $3 billion for Idaho companies. And, you know, we see some big deals pop here and there, but it's rare to see two large deals happen so close together.
Yeah, no kidding. Absolutely. So, Logan, the Idaho Supreme Court threw out a case in regards to a sale of the Idaho Department of Transportation's campus. Before we get into that lawsuit, can you remind folks what actually happened in order to get to this point?
Sure. Yeah. Big week at the state Supreme Court this week.
Yeah.
So this is about the Idaho Transportation Department's former headquarters campus. It's the big kind of tealish green building on State Street. And it's kind of been up in the air for a while now. The state, over the last couple of years, had made moves to sell the building and the 44-acre parcel that it's on. And they were pretty close to closing the deal back in kind of around the New Year's turn this year. And then during the legislative session, our lawmakers decided that they were not happy with how much money the possible sale was bringing in. And they passed some legislation in the budgets to block the sale from going through. The developers then filed a lawsuit, and that is the action that was before the court this week. And we found out on, I believe it was Tuesday, that the court has dismissed the case. And so they've said, sorry, developers, you're out of luck here.
Hmm. So, Logan, did they give any reasoning as to why they dismissed the case?
They did. They dismissed the case due to a lack of standing, which is kind of 101 of the American legal system. Courts don't just get to do stuff. They can only do things if someone comes and asks them to do it and if that's the right person to ask them for it. So the developers were arguing that the state, specifically their argument was that the language put into these budgets to block the sale was unconstitutional. And because the court decided they lacked standing, the court did not get to that point. They said, yes, the developers showed they had been injured because they had spent all this money in pursuit of the sale that didn't carry through. But ultimately, the court said without a signed contract, basically all of the options that the court had in front of them, if they had done any of them, nothing the court could do would guarantee that the sale would be completed. So basically said the court decided that because they couldn't force the sale to go through, they could only throw the ball back to the Department of Administration to decide whether or not to finish the sale. They kind of washed their hands of it and said this is not the proper venue. Now the interesting part is they did say if ITD itself wanted to file a lawsuit and challenge the budgets and say the budgets are unconstitutional, the executive branch, the state government, would have standing to do so. But the court said the developers are not the right people to challenge this and threw out the case.
So, Scott, why was this ruling seen as such a surprise to some folks?
Well, it was particularly seen as a surprise to the developers. The developers, you know, remind everyone that this was a lengthy process. This went on for about 2 years, and there was an early round of bidding that wasn't up to snuff, and so they threw out all those bids and did another round of bids. And again, this was the process. This was the already legislatively approved process for doing this, for disposing of land and selling land. And they did everything right. And it was no secret. It was done in the open. And Hawkins Companies and other developers came out on top of the bidding. It was announced with a press release and stories. And it was $52 million. They were the high bidder. And then in the last legislative session, some legislators said, gee, I don't think we got enough money for this. Let's change the process. And so they tried to do that and they couldn't. They got shot down when people realized what they were trying to do. And so then at the last minute of the session, they snuck in this budget bill, which again, as Logan pointed out, still has some constitutional questions. But the main thrust of the decision that came out this week is that, as we should all know, a handshake is not legally binding. And you know, the way I read it, when the Idaho Department of Administration declared Hawkins Companies and the other developers the high bidder, that was the handshake. They said, okay, you won the bid. Unfortunately, they didn't have a signed contract by the time the bill passed. And so they are out of luck.
Jim, I'd add two things to Scott and Logan's excellent reporting here. One, I don't think this is over. Two, as I've noted on your program before, the other developers that were finalists offered a little bit less money, but they would close immediately, AKA last fall. The Hawkins bid was a little higher and it was a longer close period. Had ITD, Department of Administration, I should say, had ITD, I can't even correct myself and I still say it wrong. If the Department of Administration had picked one of those other bids, this would have been over before the legislative session had started.
Okay.
And can I throw another?
Yeah, absolutely, Logan.
I was very surprised that they dismissed this petition because they had oral arguments scheduled for later this month. We were expecting the attorneys for the state, for the attorney general, for the developers, for ITD and admin. We were expecting all these attorneys to show up in court in a couple weeks. And the court read through the documents one more time and said, actually, we've got enough information here in the filings. We don't need to go to oral argument. We can tell here that there's nothing we could do to fix the developer's problem. So they're not the right people to file this lawsuit.
Well, the Department of Administration could have signed this last spring before the legislation was done. The Department of Administration is under the direction ultimately of the governor and chose not to do that. And so you can ask yourself why, but that could have also happened. So there was a couple of routes that this could have taken that didn't, and now here's where we are.
And I've reached out to the governor's office as well to ask if they plan on following up with this lawsuit from the state executive branch, and I've not gotten a response back yet on that. So that's a question mark as well.
Okay, well, good to know on this, and I think you're right. This is not the end of this for sure. Nicole, the bench fire, and folks might remember, this is the fire that threatened Redfish Lake Lodge earlier this summer. It was determined to be human caused, and the cost to fight that fire was, you reported upwards of $12 million. So, Nicole, I know that you looked into who pays for this, right, when a fire is human caused, and what did you find out?
Right. So I was interested in looking into this because, you know, obviously the bench fire was really high profile as firefighters were working really hard to protect Redfish Lake Lodge and that whole area. And we also had a big fire in 2022 called the Moose Fire. It was the largest one in the state that year, and that was also determined to be human caused. And so, you know, when we have these lightning caused fires, obviously there's not really anybody that you can point a finger at and say, hey, you should have done something differently. Mm-hmm. But when we're seeing these, you know, escaped campfires or exploding targets or fireworks that are starting really large, really expensive fires, all of us as taxpayers end up paying the bill for these a lot of the time. So part of the complicating factor is, you know, in the instance of the bench fire, it started up by a remote lake that's only accessible by hiking. So how do you identify who might have been in that area? So there's already that challenge of even trying to find a person or a suspect or a list of suspects. And then after that, you know, how do you get somebody to pay $12 million? That's not really a reasonable sum for most of us. And we had the Table Rock fire back in 2016. A lot of folks will remember. There was a 19-year-old who was identified and prosecuted for setting off illegal fireworks. And that total came to around $400,000. And he's paid back maybe a couple hundred at this point. And so it just goes to show sort of that difficulty of how do you even find that person? And then how do you kind of claw back that money that's already been spent on firefighting services when it becomes such an absolutely enormous sum.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate the reporting on that, Nicole. So Scott, the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland made a visit to Boise earlier this week. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's not every day the U.S. Attorney General visits Idaho. But yeah, Merrick Garland was here in Boise this week. He was meeting with key law enforcement officials, including the police chiefs of the Treasure Valley and the Ada and Canyon County sheriffs, Idaho State Police leaders, along with members of federal agencies like ATF, DEA, FBI, and IRS. And you may recall that Merrick Garland was nominated by Barack Obama to be a Supreme Court justice, and his nomination was held up by the Senate at the time. And then President Joe Biden nominated or appointed him Attorney General. Now, it was interesting. The meeting itself was interesting. You know how sometimes they say this meeting really could have been an email. Well, I think this press event really could have been a press release. A bunch of reporters, we gathered in the conference room of the U.S. Attorney's Office, including Boise State Public Radio's Troy Oppy. Good to see him again. And we waited for about an hour and 20 minutes for the Attorney General to show up. And then U.S. Attorney Josh Hurwitz introduced him, and then Merrick Garland gave 8 minutes and 24 seconds of comments, and then the reporters were all escorted out of the room. No questions. We were not able to watch the meeting or witness the meeting. And I caught up with Ada County Sheriff Matt Clifford afterwards, and he said that they did indeed talk about fentanyl, which is a big issue in Idaho. And Matt Clifford told me that Merrick Garland was very receptive and understanding about the problems and had a deep understanding of what was going on, and talked about the Mexican cartels. They talked about the cooperation that goes on in Idaho among the different agencies, local, state, and national. And Merrick Garland highlighted the reduction in violent crime, the reduction in homicides going on in Idaho, and talked about some of the successes of his office in fighting crime. So it was good to see him. And he brought along U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar, who is a Boise native and who has argued recently before the Supreme Court, most notably the Idaho abortion EMTALA case. And Merrick Garland had some really great things to say about her, saying that she's one of the great, most exceptional legal minds in this country. So it was good to see him, but, you know, really could have been just a press release.
A little lackluster, to say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don, there is a condo project being proposed in McCall. Can you tell us a little bit about this and where it would potentially be?
Yeah. If you're familiar with the Mile High Marina in McCall, it is directly across Lake Street from that, right by the boat ramp. Proposal here would build a series of three-story condos with ground floor retail. So the retail would kind of face out towards the marina and add some, you know, maybe a coffee shop or something there by the marina. And then above that would be two stories of condo. The middle level would have garage and some living space and a bedroom or two. And then the upper floor, which would probably have some nice views of Payette Lake, would have main bedroom, indoor, outdoor living, and some other things. This project has been grinding its way through the McCall planning and zoning process for a bit, and it would add these five condos right there. The Planning and Zoning Commission approved the design on a 5-1 vote. Everybody liked it, but one commissioner said it didn't really look like McCall and was a little too modern. But expect to see this, if financing and everything comes together, probably break ground next year.
Oh, really? So at this point, it will happen?
Yeah, it's looking like it. It's got kind of all of its preliminary approvals. You never know. I've had people tell me, you always write about these things and they never happen. And I'm like, well, yeah, because I can't finance them all for people. But so you just never know what will happen. Any project can fall apart at any time until it's open. But yeah, that's kind of what it's looking like right now.
Yeah, that's very true. Okay, Nicole, this story is fascinating to me. Tell us about a lawsuit that is involving pygmy bunnies. So these are what, the smallest type of rabbit in the United States?
So I've heard smallest rabbits in North America and also smallest okay. rabbits in the world, potentially. That one was kind of back and forth. They're so adorable. They're so tiny.
They really
they're
are.
Usually like full grown under a pound and less than 12 inches long. So they're these rabbits that are found in Idaho. They're actually their scientific name. They're named for Idaho. And so they're found here and in our neighboring states and in California. And there's a small population of them in Washington that is considered endangered and threatened because its habitat has been broken up. And so conservation groups have been asking for a while for actually since 1991, I believe, for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to consider putting these pygmy rabbits under the endangered species list for the entire population and not just the small population in Washington. These rabbits live pretty exclusively in sagebrush steppe area and between housing developments and wildfire and infectious disease. They're facing some pretty difficult threats. So some of these groups petitioned U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service 2023, last year. And they asked the agency to take a look and decide whether these rabbits need protection. And under the Endangered Species Act, Fish and Wildlife Service has 12 months to decide whether it's going to move forward and propose a rule to potentially list the animals or to throw it out. And it has been about a year and a half since that petition was filed, and they still have not gotten a response from Fish and Wildlife Service. There was a preliminary finding that said, hey, we think there's enough information here that we want to look into it more, that this could potentially be a situation where the species needs protecting. But that last action happened in January. And so it's pretty overdue. And these groups have said, the longer you wait, the more danger these bunnies are in. And if you don't act now, we're going to file a lawsuit.
Okay. Appreciate that update. Don, I have about 2 minutes left in the show. Can you talk to us about some changes that are coming to Payette Brewing?
Yeah, Payette Brewing has signed a deal with Upslope Brewing of Boulder, Colorado. They are not selling. It's important.
Okay.
It's a partnership. There will be no changes to staffing. But most of Payette's beer production will leave Idaho and move to Colorado. Payette will still do a little bit of its beer production here and will also make its canned cocktails in Boise. The tap house in Boise will remain, and they will actually add some products from Upslope. This is reporting from our managing editor, Gretchen Parsons. But definitely some change here. Upslope will also start offering, if you happen to be in Boulder, will be also offering Payette's product. So they're kind of working together here, but no change of hands, no real changes, except that most of Payette's products will no longer be produced in Idaho.
Huh. Okay. Well, I mean, that's good that at least, you know, there's no, you know, no selling of Payette. It's staying in Idaho. With that said, I sure appreciate all of you and you taking your noon hour on Friday to come and talk with us. We've been speaking with Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter for the Idaho Statesman, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Remember, folks, do go look at all of their reporting. We've got some really incredible journalists. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.